I was going to take some Q&A with the stuff that you learned this morning. Anything on your mind, personal, professional. Love to answer questions. 0 to 1 is always harder than 1 to 100 when it comes to questions. Aubrey.
You always talk about like asking. Asking for help, and a lot of people struggle with it. I found that in my trying to ask, or in other people trying to ask, it sometimes comes across as entitlement. Like, it's like an awkward. Is there like a way, or is that just through learning and doing it a bunch of times?
So what makes asking awkward, number one, is contrary to human nature. And so understanding that faith is involved in asking, that ultimately when we ask, the more faith we have that there's more than enough of everything, the easier it is to ask. Because number one, we know there's more than enough, so why not ask for it? Because there's always more of it. And two, the reciprocity that exists in the infinite loop of giving, that the more we give, the more we're given, not the more we give, the more we receive. So when we look and utilize gratitude and forgiveness in order to elevate our awareness to all that we're given, so we don't feel punished by the evidence that appears from asking or from giving. So what happens is we give, and then there's evidence, and the evidence is either non-existent or contrary to what we perceive to be receiving promotion, protection, love, and perfection, some sort of benefit. Because we're human, we're not omniscient. We're interfering with the omniscient. We're human, we're not all-powerful. We're interfering with the all-powerful. And so in the context of faith and in asking, if we truly believed that giving and receiving are one, that the more we give, the more we're given, if we truly believe there's more than enough of everything, if I truly believe that, and you know, if I wanted a sandwich and you guys had 100 sandwiches right here, I would be more confident in asking for a sandwich with these two guys and 100 sandwiches, because I can see the evidence is there's more than enough sandwiches for these two guys, and they'll go bad if I don't take one. In other words, when people are capable of helping us, it's the best feeling in the world. We all feel good when we give to other people who are capable of giving. Where the awkwardness comes in is understanding, one, how much faith do I have? One, there's more than enough of everything. And two, the capability of the other person is inherently giving us faith or confidence or a comfortable feeling. So I know they're very capable of giving me a sandwich because there's 100 sandwiches on the table. But when I ask people, and I don't know the time, emotion, and value in the relationship that exists, and I ask you, hey, will you fund my black belt, you know, jiu-jitsu program? Well, in your perception, I may be very capable of doing that. But what you don't know is I have priorities and previous commitments and my own timing and risk tolerance. So although, yes, I'm capable of funding almost anything anyone asks me for, I have to say no. And there's a possibility of that when you're asking, which creates this awkward feeling, which then inhibits us from being abundant, which is, it's still abundant. There's still more than enough of everything for everyone. It's just a matter of prioritization, not a matter of scarcity. That there's a reality of timing and risk tolerance in the amount of capability I have within the context of my human experience and the amount of risk I'm willing to take. And so when we start understanding this, we get more confident and comfortable in asking people, and we get more comfortable and confident when the situation arises that we perceive they're capable and they say no to us. And so within this relativity, we have to have comfort and confidence in asking and be okay with someone saying no, which really means, by the way, and this is the way I define it in both asking and being asked, not at this time, right? My most popular videos are about no. 25 no's to get a yes. It's a great perception to have. Or my 3 no rule, which is always taken into account the management development of expectations, which we call exceeding expectations, Peter, right? We're exceeding expectations by managing and developing the expectation that time, emotion, and value changes instantly when we come to an agreement or decision, instantly time, emotion, and value changes.
I wonder in the business that you're developing, where we'll follow up, there's this question of asking is often a relationship connection request. It's not necessarily a sandwich request. I'm not giving you something, but what I'm doing is I'm connecting you with someone from finance.
Which is still a capability.
It's still a capability, but to me, is the risk that as known, the feeling that I'm not worthy to be connected to someone that's in your network?
All the time. All the time. Right, but I'm not worthy of receiving... Right, but I'm not worthy of receiving a sandwich. I'm not worthy of receiving $1,000. I'm not... It has no, to me, relativity other than worthiness is directly related to how comfortable and confident you are. Right? If you feel worthy, you're going to be more comfortable and confident in asking for what you're feeling. If you feel a diminished capacity, a separation, an inferiority or a superiority, it's going to inhibit you from being confident and comfortable in asking. And where we have to get to is to understand that asking in itself has no bearing on value other than the bearing of having faith that there's more than enough of everyone and it just might not be the right time, emotion, or value for the other person in order for them to be able to be capable at that time of providing what you're asking for. People ask me all the time, hey, most common, right? They won't be transparent about why they want me to help them or coach them. What they really want to do is get on Ed Milet's podcast. And Darren can come up here right now because Darren gets this a lot, right? You'll feel it. They want your help. But what they really want to do is they want to get to have a meeting with David Goggins because somehow they think that, you know, getting on Gary Vee's podcast will change their entire life, which just isn't true. And if I ask Gary Vee for you to go on his podcast, now you're actually diminishing your capacity because you become a favor. Now, Gary Vee asked me, who do you know that would be a great guest that a lot of people may not be aware of? And I tell him, look, you should interview Darren Prince. Oh, he's Magic Johnson's agent, Goggins' agent. A lot of people may don't know who he is, but he's an incredible interview. Or like the California Kid, right? Like I do with thousands of interviews and like that's as good as it gets for me as far as an engaging story of a dude that literally is, you know, played football at USC, is doing business with the cartel. Oh, there he is. Owen's right there. Doing business with the cartel. I'm sitting there. I knew pieces and parts of the freaking story, but I'm sitting there going, when I forget I'm interviewing someone because they're telling me the story, I know it's fucking gold, right? Owen's story is gold. So is Darren Prince's. And so, you know, I will tell people and they're like, hey, you know, can you introduce me to Ed Milet? Absolutely. If you want Ed Milet to think you're a favor, because he knows if I'm asking him to meet you or to get on his podcast or to write something for you, he knows it's a fucking favor. He's not stupid. So if you want to be put into the favor category and know how that is when someone asks you a favor and you feel obliged to do something because your friend is asking you to do it, I'm more than happy to do it, but I want you to be well aware that's probably not what you want. What you may want me to do is to start elevating Gary Vee's or David Goggins or Darren Prince's awareness to why I like hanging out with you. To say, man, have you read Mel Robbins' book, Let Them? Or have you seen Owen Hansen's book, California Kid? Have you heard this story? It's going to be a movie for sure. Like even back there. You guys didn't know who Owen was before you got here, I promise you, because the majority of the world doesn't know who he is right now. But when they do the movie about him, because you all said to me, oh, yeah, they'll definitely do a movie about that kid. And I think, you know, if I can be a part of that movie, I know the guys that are starting to do it. I want to be a part of it because I know something that really needs to be told and moves people. Speaking of which, Darren Prince, come up here for a sec. I was just covering for parking time. He's speaking? Oh, just us two.
Yeah,
just sweet. Give me a big hug.
We're two mama's boys, by the way. He left.
Love you. That was my turn. You sit there, kid. Your good side?
Yeah.
This is my good side. They're picking on my posture again. I got to sit up. All right. Want to just take questions from them? It's more fun.
Sure. I got to touch on one thing.
Yeah,
as Nick is walking me up, there's a big podcast I did maybe about a year ago. I'm not going to mention who it is. The exact text all back and forth. The guy goes, I would owe you forever if you can get me Chevy Chase. He's my dream guest. And Chevy's been a client for 31 years. But it's very common. You know, we're
used to it, you know. And I like telling people what that means and what it is. You know, if you want me to vote a favor, I'll ask, but he's going to know you're a favor.
Hey, I tell people my Jay Shetty story all the time. I met Jay. We're a mutual friend, big podcast guy. Got him Dennis Rodman. Got Lewis Howes, Jerry West. Jeannie Buss is a very dear friend of mine, the owner of the Lakers. And Jay asked, could I ever get her? You know, he loves the story. And Jeannie's watched the podcast at the time, but she's like, you know, Darren, it's the middle of the season. I kind of don't want to do it. I don't want to talk about the team. I'm like, Jeannie, it's not about the team. It's about your journey. It's about your purpose. Very little bit is about basketball. And she's like, oh, you know what? She goes, if you can go that angle, maybe I'll do it. Jay calls me up in January. It was maybe a few years ago, right in the middle of his on-purpose tour. I've never been that guy that asked for anything. Just like you said, the favor is not me. Calls me up. He was in England with his wife. It was 5 a.m. my time in L.A. He forgot, because I was born and raised in New Jersey, that I moved to L.A. 8 years ago. And he apologized and said, hey, man, no, call me later. I'm like, Jay, it's impossible to get you on the phone. I'll talk to you now. He goes, I wanted to call to thank you for getting me Jeannie Buss. She's been like a dream guest. She's so empowering to females all around the world. He goes, man, you always come through for me. And we just started talking life. And just like Dave being a healer, living in that frequency and that vibration, I can tell when somebody's off. Quick little side note, I'm 16 and a half years sober. And my whole life is about energy, awareness, recovery, helping people. I'd say, Jay, you sound exhausted. What's going on? He goes, man, this on-purpose tour, it's just got me completely drained. And I came here to check out, and I gave him some nuggets on how I live life after I wrote my book. And it was successful. It certainly wasn't on purpose and sold, you know, millions of copies. And he's like, brother, every time I speak to you, there's like a magnet or something calling me to my heart. I would love if you would be a guest on my podcast to tell your story. And there you go. It's one of the biggest podcasts in the world. And didn't ask. I think you have to, you do because you do. You try to get these stories, because I also feel that when you talk about the California kid, like, I think the everyday people are the ones that are relatable. I think those are the stories that you want to hear. When David Goggins gets on stage, and I've been his agent for 3.5 years, he's magnificent. He's the greatest speaker out there. He's a cultural phenomenon. I've booked Tom Brady. I've booked Magic Johnson for 30 years. Love Tom, Magic, his family. They can't compete with Goggins. He's a regular, everyday type of guy that just went deep into hell and came out on the other side. And also, he served our country. So I think it's about that identification. I think so much emphasis is on the celebrities in today's world. And even though it's my livelihood, I get so much more. I mean, you mentioned Mel Robbins. I've been, for the past 3 weeks, every night with my audiobooks, so listening to Let Them.
Let Them is great. Yeah. Which, to that end, between Darren and I, and the management that we've had over the years of celebrities and athletes especially, I don't think Darren's ever asked me for one guest, and I've never asked him for one. In fact, he wanted me to meet David Goggins, because I'm on the Aspire tour with them. He just thought that we would enjoy each other. And I told Nick, I said, I'm going to do this because Darren really wants me to meet him, but I hate the awkward, because everybody else was there to meet him to take a picture. Yeah. And I was there just to get to know him.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're looking at you like, who's this guy? I didn't want to be a favor.
But I loved about, because you were there too, Nick. And it was like, you know, if it's a problem, don't worry. I'm like, no. This is happening. I've tried to do it a couple times. You were on early. He always closed out Aspire.
Yeah.
We're making it happen right now.
I learned one thing. David Goggins is much more popular than David Meltzer. The Aspire Tour, I closed out. I was the closing keynote in Santa Clara with Joe Montana, who you brought there.
Yeah, that was your birthday.
That was my birthday. And so I was the closing keynote. And they always run over. And so it was, and they used to do much bigger venues than 3,000 person venues. They would do like 13,000 person venues. So it was already not sold out. But man, it was humbling to be the closing because people left, right? I will tell you this, what I respect about David G is, man, nobody leaves. He's the best person to have a closing keynote from because nobody will leave. They all will be there. Yeah. I'm a great opener. Because one, I'm on time and I'll keep them on time. So the whole day. And two, people are going to show up regardless at the beginning of the day. All right. Great wealth of knowledge between both of us and complementary perspectives. What questions you got? Yes, Anish.
So I run a LinkedIn influencer agency. It's a relatively new space to be in. I'm at a scale now. We went from 6 creators in August to 25 in December, and I'm capped at that point for quality control. How have you scaled when it comes to like prioritization and things of that? Like, what are some of the like the decision criteria you think about when you're thinking about scaling to the next level? And, you know, there's only so much of your own time. People come to the agency for me and how I take care of them. And I know there's a training element to it, but who you decide to spend your time with. I'd love to learn your perspective on how you prioritize.
So for me, it's like a balance professionally and personally. You know, we always use the word frequency. I mean, any of the celebrities we work for now, too, everybody's family. Dominique Wilkins, you know, Magic, Larry Bird, Hulk Hogan, just so many iconic people that we've been around for, you know, 30 years now. Charlie Sheen, Carmen Electra. I need to feel an exchange at this stage of my life. And I think a lot of times when people are younger and they're grinding, they get out in business and their personal life, it's a waste of energy in a lot of situations and a lot of environments that they put them into. So it's even people in my personal life. Like, I need to know that somebody is on some level of a personal development journey, some level of accountability, some level of not complaining, you know, waking up. Like I learned in recovery, I'm a glasses half full type of guy. You know, I focus on the positives. I don't dwell on the negatives. I love when I'm in the barrel. Dave knows it too. The barrel moments of life is where the growth comes. So when those barrel moments happen for me and the business is upside down or sideways or there's a big issue with the client or a person or ship, that's when I step on my game. You know, I love that because I don't learn anything about myself when life is going great. I don't learn anything about myself when we're crushing it on all cylinders with all our clients and our celebrities and athletes and, you know, people that just understand that, you know, whether you're in your 20s, teens, 30s, 40s, 50s, like, life's just not supposed to be smooth sailing for anybody. Anybody that's an entrepreneur knows we have a million times more failures than we ever have wins. Even the ones that I know are billionaires will tell you that. We just don't talk about the failures. We learn from them. Sometimes there's a commonality why, and, you know, his situation when he went bankrupt, but, you know, how miraculous it is for him. And I think we need to give him an applause that he went through what he went through to go bankrupt to that level and built it back up even more massively. And I always tell him that's one category, right? We don't want to beat each other in.
Right. Yeah.
So please on that one, because he's a remarkable human being to go through something like that and really just go deep within. And I think a lot of us don't pay enough attention to, I think when we're on that journey of having a purpose and awareness and accountability, you will attract the better people that you want to be spending your time with just by default living in that vibration. It just happens. And I've been an entrepreneur since I was 14, so 41 years now. And it took me a long time to understand that. I was getting depleted on my energy level with a lot of the wrong people.
And there's an energy gap with celebrities, athletes, billionaires. And if you can get to a conversation with anyone, especially them, who are more closed off, more protective, mm-hmm. because of so many people, between the I am conversation compared to this is what I want people to think I am. Because if they can be vulnerable and honest with you, the bond is great. And I remember 4 in the morning before COVID, because I was going to the gym before I started working out in my garage. And Darren called me, and it was the first time we really got vulnerable with each other. Yeah. And you know, that was the start of our true friendship, our true bond, beyond two guys that were more on the edge of, hey, this is what everybody thinks I am.
Yeah.
And then we both got to, well, this is who I am, D. And
you picked right up.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It was 421 or something. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry to talk a little bit. Heard this phrase recently, identity has a 2-year.
So I like that.
Growth, you know, we're constantly here to change and develop ourselves. And as we start to decide who I'm claiming myself to be now, sometimes it takes a couple years for us to catch up. This is where option syndrome and a lot of those things take place. What are your recommendations having gone through some of these kind of stages where you might be entering into a new field, you might be making asks or offers to new people as you're coming into yourself? To, I guess, both find ways, not only to own it, but to shift other people's perception of you as your old self. Because where our own identity is delayed by a couple of years, other people may always still look at
it. Yes, snapshots. Can I handle this real quick and then you give your perspective? Because I love this one. Remember when I talked about we're limited by the meaning of our past? We have control to give meaning to everything we see, so do other people. And so we have to be forgiving of our past, not just for our own meaning to align with our divine direction, but other people's meaning. And the best story that I have about this was when I turned, I'm the chairman of Unstoppable Foundation, very important to me. We have 17 sustainable villages built. We donate millions of dollars. I donated 2 different community centers. I decided when I turned 50 in the sports theme to do the 50 for 50, which originally my idea was I go to 50 different, every week I go to different cities, 200 cities. So I figured I normally take my friends out to dinner when I go to the city. I'm going to take my friends out for dinner, get some content and pay for dinner and then say, hey, could you guys donate to the Unstoppable Foundation? And do that kind of once a week. Well, it took off into people threw huge parties for me, which ended up being the most emotionally draining thing of my life to have 50 humongous birthday parties for charity where you have to attend and be on. And it was serious stuff. Well, at the very biggest one, the board was sitting with my family and my Uncle Jerry, whose snapshot of me is in my early 20s. And he actually said to the founder of the charity, how much are you guys paying David to do this? And my wife was at the table and she is not as patient and forgiving as I am and freaking lit up, came running to me. Can you believe your Uncle Jerry? He fucking, in front of everyone, is like, how much are you being paid to raise money for your own charity? I can't, that's disgusting. And I said, whoa. My Uncle Jerry only knows 22, 25-year-old David. I haven't spent much time with him. And I would tell you it's a pretty fair bet that 22 to 25-year-old David would have figured out a way to make money to raise money for the charity. So why are you getting upset over a snapshot or meaning somebody else gives me when you know who I am today? And you should rejoice that I'm not that guy and take the opportunity to explain and make a joke of it. Because when I'm at the table and people bring up snapshots of me where I used to have a need to be offended, I will lean into it, kind of like Saved in the cocaine comment, right? He's like, I love cocaine. I'm like, yeah, who didn't? Right? You lean into it and then say, but I'm not that guy anymore. I'm not that person. And it took 1,000 steps to get to where I am. And remember, in 1,000 steps, 90% of the effort, 90% of the time gets you to 25% of the way. It gets you to 250 steps. Then it's less than 5% to get to 500 steps. Then it's less than 5% of the effort and time to get to 100. Then it's less than 5% to get you 200, 400, 800. And that's why people quit. That's why people give the wrong meaning to what it is, because it takes so many steps. And the majority of the time and effort is spent on the first 250 steps. It's faster to 500 steps than to 1,000 steps. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Lee.
No, I mean, I second so much what you said. Yet we all have a past. You know, one of the first things I disclosed to you guys, I'm 16 and a half years sober. That means by the time I started using at 14 for 24 years of my life, I was a highly functioning drug addict, eventually an opiate addict, and representing some of the most iconic stars in the world. Joe Frazier's documentary just aired on Saturday night. I was interviewed in it. And what would have and should have been the pinnacle of an inner and external space of my career. It's the first time I spoke about in details about working with Joe Muhammad Ali for 16 years and making the iconic reunion happen at the 2002 NBA All-Star Game. I mean, presidents, world leaders would have done anything to be in the room that night for with Muhammad and his wife Lonnie and his then best friend Howard Bingham, the famed photographer that's since passed. And I'm snorting Oxycontins and Percocets 30 minutes before I walk into that room. Sat center courtside with them the next day at the NBA All-Star Game. All this stuff could be, you can go on Google and see it. You'll see me. I mean, my eyes are probably half shut. I'm sweating my ass off. I remember the same thing. I made sure security got Joe set up and Ali. And I'm running in the middle of the tunnel to go to the VIP bathroom to smart some Percocets. You know, it's who I was back then. That's not me anymore. I found God. I found recovery. I love talking about this because I know everybody's got struggles. Everybody has an addiction. It could be to your phone. I mean, whatever it might be. And what do we have to do to rise above it? And then once we get there and we do the inner work to rise above it, what's your purpose? He's got his foundation. Every time I'm invited somewhere, I'm honored to contribute to it. I have my Aiming High Foundation. Matilda runs my company. She's here, and she knows how passionate I am about my 501c3, the Aiming High Foundation. There's not a better feeling in the world for me, a better way to slowly, continuously fill that hole in my soul than to scholarship somebody that is struggling with mental health or substance abuse. You know, I never look back, but there's no shame. There's no embarrassment. We're in a world where a lot of people don't realize, because of social media and all the attention, vulnerability and transparency is the biggest superpower you could ever have. You know, when I wrote Aiming High, and we cried during that interview, my memoir, and almost every other interview we cry anyway, I didn't write it thinking, what was going to happen as a byproduct. Even on the business front, I didn't get sober for financial again. I got sober for me. I got sober because I wanted to die the last 2 years, and I didn't have the balls to put a gun in my mouth. And I think along the way, I started to realize, wow, this is actually something that I'm so comfortable with, that if we can get into a room full of people and everybody can throw their crap out there and talk openly, what a better way for the world to live, you know, instead of being so judgmental and bullying and everything that goes on. So like I said, anybody, we all have a past in here. You know, you don't shut the door on it, you learn from it. But you let your past make you better, not bitter.
Yeah, and both of our moms passed recently.
Recently,
yeah. And I know when I first found out, I went for a walk with my wife and I was wrecked. And I said, God, there's no cement. She's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, there's no cement. I said, my mom, she loved me unconditionally, was proud of me unconditionally, and always had my back unconditionally, even when I didn't deserve it. And I know you were the same son. And then Darren called me and he said, hey, your mom, she got to meet the real you, the best of me, the one that lived up to the unconditional love, the unconditional amount of pride in how proud she was, and the unconditional ability to have your back at all times. You were that guy when she died. You may not have been 18 years previously when she told you you believe in the wrong God, when she told me I was lost, told me I needed to take stock in who I was, but that's not who she left. She left someone she knew that would be worthy of her love, how proud she was, and your mom as well. And I know it's a great joy to know that when people are unconditional, they do and allow you to change and give you a new snapshot and give you the benefit of the doubt, a second chance, but doesn't take away from the people that won't. And you should respect that because it will remind you. One more question, then we'll bring Chad up. He's a little taller than you. Let's go over here to Peter. Aubrey loves.
So we've talked a lot about these great conversations and vulnerability. Can you share a little bit about the difficult conversations, particularly with people that you represent, where you have to tell them things that they didn't want to hear, that could impact not just your business, but your personal relationship?
Yeah.
And how you thought about that?
Well, I worked with Dennis Rodman for 25 years. I haven't, spoken so much in a while. Saw each other in Chicago a couple years ago. Still always have love for one another, but you know, he kind of went on his own journey and path. And prime example was North Korea. You guys all heard about that. I organized those trips when he, especially the first one with Vice Media, when he went to see Kim Jong-un with the Harlem Globetrotters. And that was a disaster when he came back, and he was a drunken mess on a big global interview. And I had to do something I never had to do before, especially being in recovery, and tell him, bro, if you don't check into rehab, if you don't come out clean, you know, F your freaking ego right now. There's people saying you should be arrested for treason. I'm not losing my agency over this. I got way too many good things going. I love you to death, my brother. You know, I'll go to the front of the line with you, but this is something you gotta, and he manned up and he owned up to it. He did the right thing. You know, I've had other issues with clients as well. And I think that's where the trust comes in. That's where the brotherly love comes in, whether it's a male or female client, that I'm able to speak to them like I'm able to speak to you. Because I mean, think every conversation to this day with any of my celebrities ends with us telling each other, I love you. And I think that's everything. Because I'm sure he has that with a handful of his clients, and he understood that in the culture of where he grew up, just like Jerry Maguire, which was Lee Steinberg's story. Right. I've always believed in that personal relationship, because when you need it and you have those moments of a crisis or something that is really horrific or damaging to a brand, somebody's reputation, it means a lot more coming from you. And I think for the most part, you're a lot more effective delivering the message that, hey, we got to do something about this, and you got to listen, because they have egos this big, 10 times, you know?
For me, it was real simple when my wife told me that she was going to leave me and save my life. And I did fire 3 childhood friends. And so I just simply told them, this isn't about you, this is about me. I don't like myself when I'm with you, and I'm not going to be able to control myself if I'm with you. And so I need to say goodbye. And oh, you'll for life, I promised my wife. And I think that I'm not strong enough to, that's why the only reason I'd ever move from my house was if my kids were around the wrong other kids, because I know they wouldn't listen to me. I would have listened. And it was the hardest thing I ever had to do. And I took accountability for it. And people ask me still today, 18 years later, my friends with those 3 guys, I can't be. It's worse than heroin, and it's worse than alcohol or nicotine. There's too much there to draw me to the wrong place. So let's give a big round of applause for Darren.